Thank you, Vera, and the rest of the organizers of this very interesting conference. Is that better? I said thank you to Vera and to the organizers of this very interesting conference for the invitation to come and join your discussions. I was unfortunately not a close friend and collaborator of Judith Mastai's, and we met a few times in several of the projects organized at Leeds by Griselda Pollock, and everything I have heard over the past 2 days has made me wish that I had been. And I'm also enormously pleased that something that is to honor a colleague for her work is also able to perhaps take us on and move us in some interesting and productive direction for the next phase of engagement with the institutions of visual display. The thoughts that I'm going to present here today have to do with a new project that I've started fairly recently, and which is on taking part, on the notion of participation in relation to the field of the visual. And it's part, and I want to sort of say before I sort of begin, with what may be a slightly dense kind of theoretical discussion, I want to sort of slightly locate it in the emergent field of visual culture, which is a field of work that I'm part of, and which affects certain kinds of shift, or at least right this moment, there are huge debates about what visual culture is, and I very much hope that these will not be resolved. I very much hope that we will not have a field in which is made up of this, this, and this, and that, that, and that, and those are allowed to practice it, and those are not allowed to practice it. I hope it will remain a kind of contingent field for quite a long time. In the dimension of it that I'm working in it, it's a field that I think, at least for the perspective of the paper that I want to give today, there are two elements that I would want to stress. One is the notion of criticality. I think in the paper I'll try and chart a shift from criticism to critique to what I'm calling criticality, which is a position of being embedded within the sort of the materials, the institutions, the problematics, the phantasmatics in which one is discussing. So one of the things that I think embeddedness and risk are perhaps two of the hallmarks of criticality as I understand it. And the risk has to do with the fact that I think visual culture is driven primarily by issues. And the sort of state of a field that's driven by issues is one in which what's urgent is the problematic. And very often we have neither the sort of the tools, nor the methodology, nor the kind of subject heading to operate with. And so the risk is one in which it's the urgency that drives the project rather than the kind of fully worked out mobilization of a set of kind of known components. You know, here are my tools, this is my subject, I can now go to work. So a kind of critical embeddedness in which one perceives of oneself as within the problematic rather than critically and analytically standing outside of it. And the other is this kind of notion of starting a project, beginning work from a situation of risk. For the people who are sitting on stairs and so on, there's lots of empty seats up here. And so partly, I'm sort of situating this work in a shift from the critical and the analytical, on which it's obviously very much based and in which it's grounded, to the performative and the participatory. And I think participatory is kind of the branch of the performative that I'm kind of trying to discuss. The other, I think, is the fact that within the work of visual culture, what one has is a kind of meeting ground between sort of unraveled subjects and unraveled issues. I think one of the things that we're able to kind of bypass is the notion that the subject doing the work remains in some way untouched or coherent by the work. So I've recently noticed something that I hadn't noticed before, that sort of all my papers seem to kind of be in two metonymic kind of columns. And there's kind of the unraveled inquiring subject on one side and the unraveled sort of subject of the work is on the other, and I'm kind of trying to make them speak to one another. Now, the subject of this new project is participation, and it asks a question that's both too general and not specific enough, which is, what does it mean to take part in culture at the level of the visual, and beyond the roles that are allotted to us by the sort of institutions of culture, as kind of audience, viewers, listeners, buyers of tickets, fillers of seats, etc., etc. So beyond the kind of roles which cultural institutions allot us, what other level of participation is available to us? So obviously, it's an engagement with audience, which is sort of I think in the triumvirate of art practice, institutions of display, theoretical inquiry, audience is kind of the great unasked question. And it's very much not the kind of inquiry into audience that Jana Graham was talking about yesterday, which has to do with demographics. I mean, not what that audience represents about certain kinds of conditions of life outside of the institution. So very much about the sort of the performative audience and the fact that culture takes place, is not represented, but is actually made and takes place in situ in the moment. And finally, a sort of question that I'm only just beginning to ask the questions, and I certainly don't have any answers to it. But it's to do, this whole project is to a large extent fueled by the fact that I live in London and work in London currently, and we're under a barrage of constant urgings to democratize culture. We're constantly told that culture has to democratize. And by this, I think what is meant, although it's never terribly well articulated, these edicts, I think what is meant here is accessibility and sort of populism and so on and so on. And I think this has articulated a question to me that I myself find quite urgent and quite important, which is the institutions of cultural democracy assume that what the art world in all of its myriad levels and complexities has to do is in some way sort of reproduce them, reproduce the institutions of parliamentary democracy in order to make themselves kind of more open, more accessible, more representative. I want to invert the question. I want to see what the institutions of parliamentary democracy might be able to learn from the spaces of contemporary art exhibitions, and I'm talking about a sort of broad range of spaces, in the sense that I think performative audiences produce certain kinds of engagements. Now, I think they do it unconsciously in an unplanned way. It's a question of readings. These are not street manifestations, demonstrations, conscious articulations. But I think certain things happen in the spaces of contemporary art that are performative and that do actually have something to teach the institutions of cultural democracy. So this whole project is in essence fueled by trying to understand how audiences, given an opportunity, in relation to some kind of an issue or a problem that's either embedded in the institution or the subject of the exhibition or the art on display, then produce a whole set of reactions from which we might glean a politics not yet there, a kind of politics in the making. And that's what I'm trying to do. So you can see that this is, to say the least, overambitious. But nevertheless, it seems to me kind of necessary to try and engage with. The final thing I want to say is that I really have no method by which to do this. I have not the slightest idea of how to go about this project, aside from, you know, I read a lot of political theory and philosophy right now and try and teach myself the sort of debates, the post-structuralist debates around democracy. But since I do want to do the work, and this echoes what Mary Kelly said in the first evening when she said she has no idea what she's doing, I've resorted to writing ethnographies, by which I mean that I go around exhibitions, I eavesdrop on people, I go home, and I sort of write ethnographies. And these are my records of what I think I've heard in the exhibition, or what I've seen, or what I've surmised. And all that's gotten me is the fact that no one's willing to go with me to exhibitions any longer. Because they know that 10 minutes later they're going to appear in some ethnography and they don't wish to. And so that's about it has no scientific validity, and I'm not trying to claim any for it. I'm going to try and this is rather long and rather dense. I'm going to try and sort of cut it and race through it so that we have some time for discussion. What comes after the critical analysis of culture? What goes beyond the endless cataloging of the hidden structures, the invisible powers, and the numerous offenses we have been preoccupied with for so long? Beyond the processes of making visible those who have been included and those who have been excluded. Beyond being able to point our finger at the master narratives and at the dominant cartographies of the inherited cultural order. Beyond the celebration of emergent minority group identities as an achievement in and of itself. Many of these issues and questions are being rehearsed in the arenas of displayed culture and in the shift of focus from the objects on display to the strategies of their staging and the responses of viewing audiences. Over the past generation, we have seen an extensive critique of the museum as everything from the staging ground of national histories to the performative sites of private obsessions. Artists such as Hans Hacke, Marcel Brutters, Daniel Sperry, the Gorilla Girls, Fred Wilson, and Barbara Bloom have launched complex stagings of the disavowed dimensions, both public and private, of cultural display. We've even seen institutions such as MoMA New York put themselves on supposedly reflexive display by looking at their own practices through the artworks that unravel them as museum, as muse. And this, I think, very much relates to what Johan Lamoureux was saying yesterday about this kind of look at me at any cost, even at the cost of a slightly critical unraveling, not too critical unraveling, but a slightly critical unraveling. That in a way, and it was one of the things that we found out when we started writing about museums, was that it was very hard to then in some way maintain a critical distance, because the museum, of course, loved nothing more than a critical engagement with it, which did nothing more than reaffirm its kind of position at the center. Spurred on by the work of Michel Foucault, we have looked at issues of categorization and classification, by the work of Hacke at museums as managers of consciousness through the machinations of sponsorship, by that of Daniel Buren at the way in which museums turn history into nature. From James Clifford, we've taken the understanding of the relation between collecting and colonizing, and from Hal Foster, that between establishing something called primitivism and maintaining the hegemony of the West. From Carol Duncan, we have understood how deeply notions of gender are embedded in the museum as a mode of display in a public notion of edifying space. While the Guerrilla Girls have documented the continuing absence of women artists from both permanent collections and temporary exhibitions within mainstream American museum culture. The Canadian artist Vera Frankel, sorry Vera, this was written for Elsewhere, offers another example in her documentary project accompanied by videos and performance activity entitled The Cornelia Lumsden Archive. Frankel traces through her veritable absence the shadowy presence of a fictive 20th century woman writer. She does this by scrupulously emulating the archival modes that would have represented her had she ever existed, which takes us full circle back to Foucault. From all of these theoretical and art practice sources, we have mobilized an extensive critical arsenal, which we can deploy for critical analysis of the ways in which institutions have functioned and of what they have hidden or elided or simply disavowed. It seems to me that within the space of a relatively short period, we have been able to move from criticism to critique to criticality, which I think is the moment of visual culture. Beyond anything else, that is what I identify as the moment of visual culture, i.e. from finding fault to examining the underlying assumptions of all the that might allow something to appear as a convincing logic, as in the case of all the aforementioned work on and in museums, to operating from an uncertain ground, which is what I'm calling criticality, which while building on critique wants nevertheless to inhabit culture in a relation other than one of critical analysis, other than one of illuminating flaws, locating elisions, allocating blames. In visual culture, some partial response to the questions of what comes after critique can be teased out through a shift from the traditional relations between all that goes into making, i.e. practice, and all that goes into viewing, i.e. audience, the objects of visual cultural attention. Now this, of course, builds on that mighty critical apparatus which was evolved throughout the 1970s and 1980s, and in which an unraveling of the relations between subjects and objects took place through radical critiques of authorial authorities, of epistemological conceit, and perhaps more than anything else, through the ever-growing perception of knowledge as an extended wonder through fields of intertextual subjectivities. That project is well underway, and in its wake come the permissions to approach the study of culture from the most oblique of angles, to occupy ourselves with constitution of new objects of study that may not have been previously articulated for us by existing fields. In fact, it may well be in the act of looking away from the objects of our supposed study, in the shifting modalities of the attention we pay them, that have a potential for re-articulation of the relations between makers, objects, and audiences. Can looking away be understood not necessarily as an act of resistance to, but rather as an alternative form of taking part in culture? The diverting attention from that which is meant to compel it, i.e. the actual work on display, can at times free up a recognition that other manifestations are taking place that are often difficult to read and that they may be as important as the designated objects. These little ethnographies of mine are kind of interspersed, and this is one of them. Recently, an exhibition opened at the Courtauld Institute. For those that don't know, this is the Institute of Art History of London University, and it's separate from the rest of the university, and it exists in a kind of isolated splendor. So recently, I probably don't need to read the ethnography any longer. So recently an exhibition opened at the Courtauld Institute, an exhibition of contemporary art selected and hung in the actual spaces of the Institute by the postgraduate students. The opening was jam-packed with young men and women of the art world, pushing and shoving on the narrow stairs, sloshing beer over everyone, and grinding cigarettes on the hallowed 18th century staircase. This invasion of a stiff and formal traditional academic space by the floating population of art world openings was surprising enough to someone like myself, who had studied at the Institute at an earlier phase. Instead of being hung in the more conventional spaces of the adjacent court-old galleries, the works here were distributed amongst the offices and seminar rooms of the Institute itself, and the viewers were asked to explore the spaces that are usually occupied by the business of teaching and of academic work, spaces cordoned off by the work being done in them and barred from the view of the general public. More surprising than this invited invasion was the comment I overheard again and again as I trudged up and down the stairs. "Well," the various visitors said that evening, "it's not so posh. I expected it to be a lot more posh, didn't you?" "What's all the fuss about this place?" said another. "It's just another old building, isn't it?" Ending his statement on a slightly puzzled, questioning tone, as if wondering if there was some level of the experience that had been hidden to him. I, who as a student had for years been intimidated by this place and by its snobberies and exclusivities, was endlessly amused. It was as if the Queen had opened her bedrooms to the public and everyone had come around to share in the exposure of something that had been so far hidden. But beyond the voyeurism and beyond my own amusement, at a more interesting level, a form of participation was taking place in which some facade of privilege, of class and cultural exclusion, of supposedly rarefied learning, had been breached. And the viewers were trying to figure out what exactly had kept them outside, had kept them at bay, since after all, it wasn't all that posh, was it? The exhibition project on display itself probably had in mind some notion of democratization and accessibility through undoing the boundaries of elevated separation and inserting itself in the realm of the contemporary. Its final effects, however, were almost the opposite. Rather than making people feel comfortable within its spaces, it produced, in my reading of it at least, an embodied manifestation of the mythical and phantasmatic which had kept them at a distance. It did so not through curatorial intention, but through a proliferation of performative acts generated by the audience, and of course, by our ever-growing ability to read these performative acts. There is a popular assumption that the performance of exclusion is an actual form of remaining outside, of not daring to enter spaces perceived as exclusive or intimidating or barred. Perhaps, though, the performance of exclusion is the process of realization that exclusion has nothing to do with entrance or access, and far more to do with perceptions of the possible. In the tortuous operations of trying to produce a fit between specific identities and their legible representations, the joyous possibilities of Giorgio Agamben's whatever, which I shall return to in greater detail later, are lost to us. In The Coming Community, a book that has had an enormous effect on my thinking, Agamben says the whatever in question here relates to singularity, not in its indifference with respect to a common property, to a concept, for example, to a concept. The common property is not a property, it's a concept, and the examples he gives are like being red, being French, being Muslim, but only in being such as it is. In experience of the actual space, in being positioned as an actual audience, the crowd at the courtyard exited the work of framed identities in relation to which they are positioned and judge themselves, and moved into the performative workings of the whatever. Thus, it is experiential, but not in the sense of stressing having an actual embodied experience in the space, but rather in the sense that entering a space inscribed with so many caveats and qualifications in a state of what I call unbelonging. And unbelonging, and this was sort of one of the main arguments of that book on geographies, was that unbelonging was something that we were able to mobilize for ourselves to in some way counter all of the edicts of the state around belonging. Inclusions and inclusions and rights and boundaries and borders and so on. So and I think of unbelonging as something that we can claim and mobilize for ourselves. So entering that highly qualified space in a state of unbelonging leads to the active production of questions concerning the very rights of entry and belongings in and of themselves. It is in this sense that I would perceive of it as an embodied manifestation of the mythical and phantasmatic, which kept them at a distance in the first place. It is in this moment, in the preliminary production of these questions, that I wish to recognize the shift from entering to taking part, from following the roles allotted to us, to engaging in the performative and becoming the subject of the work. And I think to a large extent, this project is focused on a kind of notion that performative audiences become the subject of the work on display. That they're not a sort of response to something, but in response to the possibilities accorded to us by certain kinds of subjects, certain kinds of displays, we can actually become the subject of the display, and that sort of produces a very different gloss on both the experience and what constitutes the subject of art. So in expanding the parameters of what constitutes engagements with art, we might in fact be entertaining an expanded notion of the very nature of participation, of taking part in and of itself, so that participation then becomes the subject of the experience rather than sort of those objects. I'm going to try and spare you some of the more long-winded kind of theoretical articulations, and then just maybe mention some of the issues that are kind of underwriting the investigation. One is the fact that we all agree in the principle of participation. Much of the political work that we take part in, both institutionally and beyond our institutions, has to do with the degree to which we believe in the notion of participation and the degree to which we would like to draw in, you know, sort of an ever broader range of peoples and subjectivities into that participation. And what's at stake is a very sort of extraordinary tension that post-structuralist political theorists like Ernesto Laclau, Giorgio Agamben, Robert Bernasconi have drawn our attention to. And that's the fact that in the wake of that kind of vast critical and theoretical project that we've undergone in the last quarter of the 20th century, we have to a very large extent fragmented ourselves into a very wide array of identities. So that we're not, you know, none of us are inhabited by a singular identity, but we have identities that encompass our sexualities and our ethnicities and our class base and our nationalities and our regional affiliations and. And yet, when we participate in the institutions of parliamentary participatory democracy, we're asked to recohere our identities and cast one vote, essentially. And so there's this enormous tension between everything that the kind of critical analytical project has put out there, around which we've fragmented and atomized increasingly, and the fact that every time we participate in any kind of centrally organized, top-down political activity, we have to recohere. And that's what I meant when I said that I was hoping that around this work by a lot of artists and a lot of theorists, that there might just be a possibility for political space to recognize that the performative that takes place in and around the institutions of culture, the displays of culture, actually has something to teach the spaces of politics in terms of recognizing the way in which people manifest, you know, their identities and all of the problems that are linked to it. Now, the other is a kind of thorny problem that Jana and I were talking about last night, and that is the fact that participation is a project that many artists and many curators have been involved with for quite a long time. In that both the curatorial and artistic practice have generated all kinds of possibilities for people to kind of interact and take part. And this has been going on, I think, since the 60s. It's a kind of long tradition and very elaborated one. What I find problematic about it, although of course none of this would have been possible without it, is the fact that within that tradition, amongst the curatorial and amongst artistic practitioners, the question that gets posed is posed, as it were, from above, very much in the same way as within sort of democratic institutions. A question gets posed, and then a whole set of answers are elicited at sort of different levels, at levels of communities, at sort of various levels. What I'm trying to sort of think about is what happens when there is no specific question pre-articulated for an audience, when the subject is so urgent, is so important, addresses people's sort of unconscious to such an extent that it elicits these kinds of unplanned performances in which people then actually articulate the question. So it's a kind of shift from participation in which a question is articulated or a mode of participation is articulated for an audience, which is something I think we see quite a lot around us, to trying to see the degree to which audiences are actually able to articulate the question. And the other another element is that the participation I have in mind goes beyond an aesthetic identification within the confines of spaces reserved for artistic practices and towards a model in which these spaces re-engage with political culture in unexpected ways. I'm conscious of the restraints of time, but for me the project started when I flew to New York to see an exhibition called Black Male at the Whitney Museum. I think it was 95 or 96. And it was a groundbreaking exhibition. And Selma Golden and the whole curatorial and advisory staff of African-American intellectuals and critics had put together the first exhibition in a mainstream museum that dealt with the representation of African-American masculinities in the plural, and it was that S that was the sort of huge difference. So I made an enormous effort to get there, and once I got there, I was terribly bored. And that was, of course, a huge problem. And so, because it was very taxonomic, it was every image of every African-American masculinity ever painted, drawn, photographed, digitalized, advertised. It was just an encyclopedic kind of survey of these images. And so after about half an hour, and enormous, I mean, it must have been about 600 objects or things there, I started looking at the audience. And my attention was sort of completely diverted because it was the first time I'd ever seen so many African-American men at a mainstream American museum. It was just very unusual. And then the second thing I noticed was how absolutely spectacularly dressed this audience was. I'd never seen an audience dressed like this. And in many ways, I mean, from Armani suits to sportswear to transvestites to the gay leather scene, but all, you know, fully thought out, beautifully presented, incredibly theatrical. And the third register was the fact that this entire audience was almost performatively reading the text at the exhibition. It was a very text-heavy exhibition. And people were reading, they were giving a performance of reading. They were paying incredible attention to the text. And the combination of the three sort of started me thinking about what it is to transpose when an audience, in an unplanned kind of unconscious way, basically makes itself the subject of the exhibition, having been given the opening by the work of the curators and the sort of conceptual advisors. That they put the subject on the table, as it were, and the audience then kind of takes it on. So I wrote a text called How to Dress for an Exhibition, kind of trying to think about the sartorial as a politics of participation. And that was then given at a meeting of curators who, oddly enough, I thought I would be very badly criticized, because I thought in a way I was taking away from the centrality of the curator that, you know, was sort of putting forward the possibilities. In actual fact, they found this interesting, and they found that they could work with it, and they also kept saying it kind of takes the onus of responsibility away from us, all that political correctness, what we're allowed to say, what we're not allowed to say. We are, I think of it a little bit like what Maimonides calls God. Maimonides says that God is the reason for reasons. And I think that the curators then become like the reason for reasons. They make something possible, and then that's kind of completed at a whole set of levels. So by claiming an interest in participation, I would like to put into question what it means to take part in culture beyond the audience functions of viewer or spectator allotted to us by most cultural arenas. Obviously, active-passive division of that old model of taking part in culture cannot be sustained in the wake of the immense rethinking of positionality that the last 25 years of theoretical analysis have launched on the work, on the world, sorry. We all come from somewhere. We all represent something. We all make and remake ourselves daily through the acts of speech and appearance. But none of these are the stable identities which we can rely on to be constant through the barrage of encounters of difference we face. Being so active and volatile an entity, we, as viewing audience, can no longer be positioned as the observers of work from the outside. And having understood how we remake work in relation to the subjectivity we project on it, we cannot unlearn this when confronted with the work of art. The question that is raised, therefore, is what forms of response replace that old model of lost identification? And do these emergent modes of response afford some mutuality that links viewers and participants beyond their named location of identity? So consequently, I've been reading various philosophers and social theorists who themselves have been thinking possibilities of the common and its articulation without resorting to the stability of identity, whether essential or constructed. At some level, it's been possible to locate in those readings possibilities for the disruption of that rapt gaze of culture which has kept us for so long in the position of edified viewers. To find alternative models of both looking away and coming together, and I think maybe this is the crux of my argument. I'm not sure I've actually fully grasped it. But I think there is something in the act of looking away that allows us to come together. And so that certain kinds of momentary communities are established in these kind of spaces. So to find alternative models of both looking away and coming together, in Giorgio Agamben's unhinging of singularity into the whatever, in Jean-Luc Nancy's insistence of the disruption of myth actually designating the absence of what it names, as grounds for political possibility. In Hannah Arendt's constant flow of made and remade, what she calls spaces of appearance. In their thought, there is a preoccupation with concepts of community that is not founded in the politics of identity, and a play with flows and ebbs of mutuality that have helped me link preoccupations with the performative to a theory of the political. For some time now, I've been getting into trouble with my use of we and us in my texts. I'm sure you do too. Frequently after the publication of some piece, I would be asked, often with great hostility, who is we? Who are us in your writing? We, they would say, who don't share your identity, be it national, sexual, political, theoretical, class, or language-based, refuse our inclusion into your argument. Well, the we I have in mind is not identity-based. It cannot be found in the named categories by which an identity is currently recognized in the world. Rather, it comes into being fleetingly as we negotiate a problem, a mood, a textual or cultural encounter, a moment of recognition. These shared mutualities do not form a collective heritage, but they do provide the short-lived access to power described by Arendt, not the power of the state, but the power of speech. In the context of this particular writing, the we I have in mind is designated through a recognition of shifts taking place in the project of theory, a shared transition, albeit expressed in different ways, that the project of theory has moved on from being a mode of analysis by which you understood what lies behind and beneath the workings of knowing and representing. Instead, theory can become the space of making or remaking of culture, of envisaging further possibilities rather than of explicating existing circumstances. Those who agree to a suspension of the purely critical, to momentarily shared imaginaries, to a bit of groundlessness, lost and regained, that's us. That's who I mean. Now, I want to sort of maybe finish with 2 points. One, in a way, addresses that last question that was asked in the panel just before the lunch break. The person who said, and I don't know if they're here now, but the person who said asked why it is we're talking exclusively about institutions of art, art museums. And I think that what I would have to answer to the kind of questions that were already put forward is that, in a way, our encounters with displayed culture have been defined by the kind of demands that something called art makes on us. And to paraphrase a long and complicated kind of philosophical argument, those demands cohere around two things. That we afford that thing we're looking at, the status of a singularity, that it is singular, and that we pay it absolute attention. So it's somewhere between the singularity, the aura of singularity, and the modalities of absolute attention that a certain kind of model of engaging with and encountering objects on display takes place. And I think that, and that certainly is something that came together around the display of art, and then has kind of passed on to other museums and other modes of display. So I think to my part in the general answer to that question has to do with the fact that the singularity of the object, everything that went into selecting it, acquiring it, choosing it, cataloging it, you know, everything that's kind of made it up there as the exponent of everything it then represents, is its singularity, and it demands from us our full attention. And so singularity and attention, I think, are part of the kind of demands that art makes on us. And I think, and in relation to that, I want to invoke Arendt's spaces of appearance. Arendt's thought links speech and action to the very constitution of power. Not power as a mode of representation, not power as the concrete articulations of ideological belief and their consequent translation into various structures of speech and of government, but, quote, what keeps people together after the fleeting moment of actions has passed, what we today call organization, and what at the same time they keep alive through mutuality lies in their ability to both stage these actions and to read them for what they are. The space of appearance in which these momentary actions take place are the staging grounds of protests, refusals, affirmations, or celebrations. And like Henri Lefebvre's space in the process of production, they do not bear the markings of traditional political spaces, but rather galvanize the spaces of everyday life and temporarily transform them by throwing fleeting mantles of power over them. So I want to end with the question of what is it that we do when we look away from art, when we break that dominant pattern of singularity and of the attention that is demanded of us by looking away. Does this act of looking away produce these kind of spaces of appearance that Arendt is talking about? When we avert our gaze in the very spaces and contexts in which we're meant to focus our attention. Theoretical analyses are also lived realities. Thus, the disruption of art singularity, of its hold on our attention and focus, are everywhere in the speech and action we produce, in the seemingly unimportant registers we engage in relation to it. I'm going to end with this ethnography. GB and I have gone to see the Jackson Pollock exhibition at the Tate Gallery. I am wary of the hyperbolic claims made for the grand master of abstract expressionism, wary of the investment in the muscular and visceral hero of modernism, wary of the equation of action, physicality, and scale with some notion of liberation and of a strike for cultural autonomy. In short, I'm critically on guard and approach the whole visit with weariness and a sense of cultural obligation. I have dragged GB along in the hope that his superior knowledge of the period and of the work, the fact that he's already visited the exhibition on several occasions, will provide me with insight and animate the encounter, chip away at my weariness. Shortly after entering the exhibition and beginning to look through the compulsions of chronology at the early work, we spot the actress who plays the beautiful nurse Carol Hathaway on the fabled TV series ER. Do you know ER? We're mesmerized. We follow her around the exhibition. She's even more beautiful in real life than on the screen. And we speculate on the color of her hair and on the relationship to her companion at the exhibition. Our attention has been well and truly diverted. And one mythic structure, the heroic modernist figure of Pollock and the art history that instates him and claims that singularity of our attention for him and for his art, has been interrupted by another mythic structure, that of Hollywood celebrity and the odd slippages between distance and proximity, reality and filmic action, that occur when it is delivered directly into our living rooms with weekly regularity. It is entirely true that both GB and I are fans of the series. At the same time, it's also true that we occupy ourselves with the critical interrogation of the meaning and status of art within broad visual culture. Were we simply swept along, interpolated by fandom and struck by glamour, or had we staged a disruption that was entirely necessary for our own viewing purposes, allowing us to exit the application demanded from us and to unframe the exhibition from the isolating claims made for it, from its mythic structures. Perhaps by willfully juxtaposing one mythic structure with another, using culture to stage our need for disruption rather than engaging in some mode of unruly behavior. Certainly in the case of the disrupted viewing of the Jackson Pollock exhibition, GB and I regaled one another with tales of our watching experience and reactions to ER, our perceptions of the characters portrayed, of the actors portrayed in them, of the evolving storyline, of the mesmerizing effects of the fast-cutting technique, which is the series' cinematic hallmark. Not only was one mythic structure mobilized in relation to another one, that of the exhibition, but a viewing position, an alternate of imbricated fan as opposed to reverential spectator, was put into play in this disruption. Myth, states Jean-Luc Nancy, begins when a group is gathered listening to a story, and the telling of that story is the entire point of their assembly. The scene of the myth is their spaces of appearance. Do I have another 2 minutes to finish? The disruption I recounted is partly an intervention in a mythic structure and the compulsion to point to the absence that it names through the deployment of a high-low dichotomy. But it is also performative and makes a claim for what Hannah Arendt calls the space of appearance. For Arendt, the space of appearance is what makes possible action. Having become aware of the very mythic nature of our own critical interventions, it is the minute gatherings of refusal and disruption which are left to us to somehow live out the combined entities of participation and criticism. To make such a statement is to somehow seemingly be gripped by a situationist ethos, by the echoes of stealthy street actions, remade topographies, and inscriptions left behind on walls. How do we occupy the space of commanding attention in ways that is not the takeover of street marches, nor the romantic covert operations of the agents of détournement? Perhaps we could say that we simply do not, that we refuse the very notion of a spatial occupation in which our identity is made subjugate to a named commonality. To my mind, the great difference between subversive action and what I am calling disruption is precisely Agamben's whatever, in all its arbitrariness and ephemerality. No form of subversive action can be without some attempt to create a fit between itself as a manifestation and a set of values and ideals it is operating in the name of. In other words, subversivity is always ideological and always consciously mobilized, even if it takes the form of an unplotted nocturnal roaming, and even if its outcomes are not foreseen in advance, as in the workings of détournement. Equally, critical practice works to unveil the hidden and to enter the battlefields of signification in order to intervene and subvert those meanings. Instead, I am hankering after the unconscious process of actually becoming the subject, which I identify as the performative, claiming that we live out Agamben's whatever in the vagaries of trivial conversations that ebb and flow, making and remaking the space of appearance as we speak of different things, inside, distracted, acknowledging that our utterances come back to us in inverted form, conceding the common while refusing its identity, that's us in the process of becoming the subjects of culture. The ethnographies of the visits to the Tate Gallery and to the Courtauld Institute and to all the other exhibitions and institutions that I'm attempting to describe in the course of this work on participation are encounters with mythic spaces in Nancy's terms. They allow me to make concrete and manifest, to stage, as it were, the unauthorized consequences of what I have called looking away, of diverting attention from all that culture demands we pay attention to. It is precisely because we're knowledgeable about the erratic value invested in art through teleology and filiation, to use Marxist and semiotic terms of analysis, precisely because we have been through such a long and protracted phase of institutional critique of the spaces and strategies of display, that we can affect such a bold leap of looking away from inside those discourses and those spaces. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Irene.